You guys want to do like a show, or you want to just have a couple of drinks and chat?
Is there a difference?
Because I'm up for you.
Are they mutually exclusive?
No.
Yeah, but
no, they're not. They're really not. why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
Cool. So I am Linda Dong, and you are?
Leah Napolitano.
And we actually both interned at Apple together. We were actually roommates while we were interns. And so I was a part of the iMovie and Final Cut team as a designer for a really long time. And Leah?
Yeah, when I was interning, I was actually working with the global business intelligence team. Belly of the Beast. Not the coolest part. But actually, it was really fun. It started out working, actually, was designing portals that to be implemented in Flash, believe it or not, and then other things that were not that heinous, and somehow that got me a job at Apple. So yeah, that was when we were interns. That's what we were working on.
Yeah, so I moved on to the prototyping team at the end of my employment there, and
then I worked with a UX team, little UX team, working on like internal and retail apps, and then I moved on to working on Siri for 2.5 years.
Okay, awesome. So, Linda, were you more of a hardware person or like a software design person?
So I was actually, the team that I was on was a part of the hardware organization. So our very super long name was the Human Interface Devices Prototyping Design Team, which basically boiled down to like me being on a prototyping team, and we envisioned like very, you know, futuristic concepts and experimental user interfaces, a lot of conceptual work. So everything we designed had a hardware component to it, but we were doing a lot of the, you know, like how that hardware integrates with software and like what that user interface looks like.
Okay. And so Leah, does that dovetail into kind of what you were doing it sounded like you were coming more from the software side.
Yeah, absolutely. Working on Siri, I was a designer within an engineering organization, and that was super interesting, very married to software. And I think the last year and a half of my time working on Siri, I was working on Apple TV and other hardware experiences. I was working on HomeKit. So kind of looking at, okay, when and CarPlay for a bit. So it's like when the
I think we know a lot of the same people.
Yeah.
That's why I'm laughing. I'm pretty sure we do.
You're looking at new pieces of hardware, and you're looking at voice and the different capabilities of hardware. You will change an experience or think about what the experience could be. But that said, we were not like driving or experimenting hands-on with hardware as much. We were using hardware as a jumping off point for the, you know, the design work we're doing. That
totally makes sense.
So
going back, let's rewind a little bit. How did you get interested in these two sort of aspects of design?
I'll go about,
go for
yeah,
it.
So
yeah.
I was interested in Apple forever. As like a young child using a Compaq running, you know, like whatever the operating system was, 9, 8.
Oh God, I don't even know.
playing Command and Conquer, like just chilling, living.
Good call. That's a good game.
It was a good game, but yeah, didn't have too many friends, but did have a great computer. So that was like where interest in Apple came from. My parents, who had actually, you know, they hadn't gone to school, but they'd started a company together, had this Mac SE. My mom was doing a bunch of hardcore graphic design, like that would take so much time to execute because the processor was not what it is today. So I was always interested in computers. I went to school thinking I would study international relations and become a lawyer. And then I had to get out of a math class, took computer science, and got really hooked. So my focus while studying CS became a focus on human-computer interaction. And I wound up just getting really into it. And the skills picked up in human-computer interaction courses led to a user experience job at Apple and internal stuff. It was the passion for kind of weird, awkward technology that was just being introduced to consumers that made Siri this really exciting fit.
So wait, that is super interesting. You say a math class dragged you into computer science, and then you ended up in
natural language interface design.
I'm not making
design.
A joke. I'm not making a joke, but you ended up in, I don't want to say the softer side, but the more humane side, like a human interaction.
Yeah. Side. Yeah, definitely. I'd always been interested. I mean, my goal, once I realized I love programming, was to do a double major in studio art and computer science. And it just happened that there was this new interdisciplinary program at my school called Media Arts and Sciences. And in that program, I could kind of do both of those things, do some independent studies where I would be prototyping, learning Objective-C, actually making the things. And so all of those interests came together. And then I guess, except for political science and lawyering.
Yeah. Well, Siri has an astute political sense of humor.
Yes,
she does.
Yeah.
Top of Game of Thrones right
so
now.
Wait, I don't know. Forgive me if you ask me, when was this? Like mid to late 90s kind of thing?
Okay, so I graduated from college in 2010. So okay. I finished high school in 2006 and was like, I love mock trial and I love arguing with people. So obviously the only way to do that is be a lawyer. And then it turns out that you can do anything and argue with people all the time. So,
yes. this is why I have this show.
Right. So timeline, we interned at Apple together in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And that was right before my senior year. It was right before, was it your sophomore or junior year?
That was actually my freshman year of college.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I was the youngin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, Linda, so what's your sort of coming up story? Like how did you get engaged with this kind of stuff?
I actually, it's sort of like the opposite of Leah's experience, where she came from like a CS degree and then kind of made her way into the humanities. Mm-hmm. I actually was very much a part of the humanities. So I was doing oil painting at the time, trying to pursue like an art degree. And I kept just being like, oh, you know, I really love practical art. Like, I didn't know what the hell it was called. I didn't know that it was called design, but I was like,
it's a discipline.
I really wish that like art could be practical. And I kept saying that. And then a professor came to me one day and was like, you know that there's an entire industry for this and it's called design. And so I was very upset with myself for not understanding that earlier. I applied for design school. I went to an industrial design major. So that's kind of where that hardware background came from. Like I was very much interested in physical products and how they interact with the world. But of course, like that was during a time, this being like 2007, that was during a time when all of like the hardware that was being released, they had a screen component. And I found myself very interested in what happens on the screen. In addition to what happens in the physical space, which is kind of what got me into interaction design.
Did you have a hard time making the leap from drawing to actual graphic design? Because for me, like I grew up drawing and you know, superheroes. Yeah. But when you take a graphics design course or like an architecture course, like that's not a technical drawing is very different. Like it's night and day to actually
so
drawing,
different.
Right? Was that a hard leap for you?
T-squares and protractors.
No, it really is. It's something totally different. Like you engage some of the same similar elements, but there's a precision that isn't warranted or needed or even like,
you're right.
You know.
I mean, like when I was making art, I mean, I started off doing like Legend of Zelda, like fan art.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
But there's a huge difference between something like that and something like illustration and then going into a more technical field like industrial design, where the purpose of the drawing is to communicate an idea or to get, sort of buy-in for an idea by making it exciting looking and like, and something that looks futuristic. And you realize that like, when you see drawings like that, it's a very learned thing. Like you learn how to make something look like of the future. And so.
Was that a leap? Because it's very different mindsets, right?
It was like, a huge leap. And
right. For one of them, you sit down to relax and to express yourself. And for the other one, you sit down and you're,
And
working towards communicating you know, like a physicality to something.
Like industrial design drawing for me was, I mean, they always taught it in a way that it was like, you're telling the story of this object through a drawing. Like you're telling like how to use this object, how it fits into scenarios. It's very much like storyboarding. Like, you know, the way like Pixar makes a storyboard of the movie, like that's what you're doing in industrial design drawing, is you're telling the story through drawings of this physical product. And making that into a narrative so that someone buys it and decides to prototype it or manufacture it. So it's a whole different story.
That's fascinating because how do you compare comic books to a Pixar or like any, you know, movie storyboarding system? A storyboard is clearly geared in towards directing a film or like directing shots, which means a lot about like the way things are lit or the way that you place the camera, or all of that kind of stuff. But at the same time, there's a creative element to it, right? Like, what's the difference between a storyboard and a comic book from your perspective?
That's a really good question. For me, like a comic book, you know, there's like an emotional narrative that's there as well. Like, so, you know, with a comic book, you're trying to, this is hard for me because I don't read that many comics, but.
No, it's a linear visual fiction, right?
Like, yeah. It's like, there's a world building in comic books that like, you're saying, this is the world that exists and this is my product that lives in that world. And this is the story that that product tells you about how people interact with like it or with other people. And I think that's like a lot of the similar, the similarities between that and ID.
It feels like the comic book is an end point where the storyboard or the object story is the beginning point.
I would say, you know, storyboards on their own. I actually don't know if I see that. I mean, maybe a key difference is just the character development is not as much the focus. It's like, it's just about the object and its use and almost creating properties of that object and scenes that show that object's character. Whereas in comic books, it's more scenes that show the character of the people or character development. And I think that might be a bit of a difference when you're looking at like the storyboarding of the context of use for an object is about how the object evolves and suits different contexts as opposed to how a person evolves. I don't know if that
No,
I storyboards are really, I was just today looking at some of Pixar's like color stories or color boards. I don't know what they're so gorgeous. It's so cool to be able to look at something from a distance and see that each frame is very meticulously illustrated and is conveying something, but then to take a step back and look at the whole and say, ah, like this is what it's about. That deliverable is being done at a high enough fidelity that it feels like a thing, just like a comic book is obviously at a high enough fidelity that is a thing.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree, which is where I'm like trying to honestly find the line between the two, because I think there's a bit sort of a continuum. But like there's a storyboard, which is a sketch in order to enable a film. And then there's a comic book, which as Renee says, is like the final, final story. So, but yeah, Leah, you make a great point about the color telling a story, which a lot of storyboards don't actually include the color washes, right? They're just like rough outs of like how the characters are going to be standing. And like I've seen some storyboards from North by Northwest with like the plane coming down and it's all, I mean, they look great. But it's not telling a narrative in terms of color.
Mm-hmm. And color itself like establishes such a like ambiance that you really can't get with like a black and white drawing too. Okay. And, you know, if we're going to like kind of segue this back into more like traditional interface design, I think like it's, yeah.
it's where I'm going. So good.
Cool. Like you see that when you're developing a cohesive like operating system. Like, I don't know how much I can say about this, but I can say that like when iOS 7 first came out, like one of the biggest things was like they hired on this color specialist to kind of analyze like all of the colors that we're utilizing in the entire system and see if we can like make that into a kind of a cohesive, like organized narrative. And I thought that was extremely interesting.
Yeah, I think Mike covered that in his WWDC talk that year. He explained the design language and philosophy and color grouping, which I thought was fascinating.
Could you explain that a little bit just for...
I'll link to the DubDub talk. I think it's still online. Is his iOS 7 design language talk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think I saw it actually.
I definitely saw it, but I don't recall.
I don't mean to corner anybody. But color is a component of interface, and human interaction is clearly a big.
Well,
big
and
thing,
what,
right?
What I find really exciting about our field is. It is not sufficient to only do one thing. Like, I think, you know, if we were to take the just interaction design purely, it's a bit about what can the thing do and how does it do it and how to, like, and it starts to hint at how does that feel, or it's inspired by some principles about how something should feel. But then I think visual design is tasked with, like, the real emotional timber of the experience. And then the actual software is responsible for being really, really on top of how the thing should work, what informs how it works on a not even tactical level, but just like this underlying level. And if one of those pieces is missing, you may have an emotionally resonant experience that doesn't work, or an experience that works really well, but doesn't move you. Mm-hmm. And I think heart between those three disciplines is so exciting and cool and challenging.
I agree. How does that relate to Siri?
So
you can just say you don't answer, but I want to ask the question. Yeah.
So it was really interesting working on Siri, because when I would tell people that I was a designer working on Siri, they were like, "Oh, so you do like the waves? the waves? Like that's what you do today? Like that's
they do look great. I gotta say."
They do, and they look amazing.
Well, there are some people who've been saying that Siri is like the end of designers making interface, because you just talk to your phone and it does everything. But that's not true at all.
No, I mean, yeah, until if only voice would be reliable 100% of the time, like
right.
Yeah.
How do you address an ambiguity in the very well defined?
So there,
user interface, right? Like
totally. I think there are two questions. So the first one was, how does, you know, visual and interaction and software design all come together with Siri? And a lot of the work that I was doing for Siri was very much in the like, how should this work? Why does it work that way? Let's specify that. Let's lay it out. What are the rules? And how does that appear to a user on a kind of high level? So, for example, working on Apple TV would be like, how much information should we display and why? Why are we doing that? How much of the screen should we take up? Context of use, someone's watching TV. Maybe we should take up less space in that case than we might feel comfortable taking up if someone's just staring at UI. And so those are the kinds of questions that I would ask and then put together some forms around that. But when it came time to really think about the way that would make someone feel, first of all, there was a team thinking about the coherent OS visual system. And so obviously they were the right people to take this framework and these layouts and wireframes and say, this is the final polish. And there was also this genius motion designer that was working on the waves in concert with a genius engineer who was working on making that function in the system. And so I'd say Siri was really interesting to work on because all of those pieces existed. The visuals may not be as obvious. And in fact, that wasn't the final polish was not what had my preoccupation, but it required really beautiful artistic work to sell the idea of Siri. And then there's also the dialogue, which I would say is beautiful and artistic. That was, you know, the personality of Siri is this layer that you don't, it's kind of reflected by the visuals and the waves these days. And, you know, it's colorful and it's exciting, but that's this other layer that you get to play with.
Like a Pixar character.
I think, well, yeah, I think, yeah. I think as much as people like to make fun of Siri, they're making fun of Siri, the character. And a lot of that is because the visual interface is so minimal.
Right.
It really is just bare bones. Like, now you're talking to somebody who is a robot.
Right.
And they want to help you. They're kind of wisecracking, and sometimes it works, and mostly it works, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, they also said in one of the sessions that they put more visual interface up when they think you're actually looking at the phone, and when you're saying, hey, Siri from a hey, commissary from a distance, they downscale the visuals because they don't assume you're looking at it. So it seems really well thought out.
Absolutely. Actually, one of my first projects at Apple was going through and saying, what are all of the things that Siri says? And then if you're in a car, do all of those things work? And for the longest time, if you got Safari results from Siri, it would say, here it is. And that was it. And for a number of reasons, it's completely unacceptable if you can't look at your phone. And so we had to kind of go through each of these experiences and say, like, what is the likelihood that you're looking at a screen? What is the likelihood that you're looking at it, but you can't touch your screen? And that you realize that voice can is not perfect. Voice isn't great. Like, we cannot read all of the web results in a perfect summarized way, right, the way you like it. No, we don't know how much time you have on your hands. And that's where visuals are a great compliment. But they, you know, I think Siri is at its best when it is beautiful and resonant and has personality, but also helps you get your stuff in more quickly than rifling through a lot of UI.
Do things change when you're in the car? Like, if you're being interacted with via CarPlay?
Yeah, it goes to much more, you know, verbose answers. It is not saying, you should look at your phone right now, because we don't want deaths on our hands.
Did you work on that, on the CarPlay stuff?
I did, yeah. It was.
Do you remember the code name for that?
No.
Really?
No.
I thought it was, I'm pretty sure it was Stark, as in Tony Stark, like Iron Man style.
No, that's impossible.
I don't think that's impossible. I think that's pretty accurate.
I was going to just backtrack for a minute and ask Linda, how do you define prototyping if someone isn't familiar with what that is in a software hardware sort of a context?
So for me, I would say prototyping is answering all of the questions that you wouldn't be able to answer in a static comp or a static visual. That's what prototyping is for me. When you have questions that are unanswered from just making a screen, whether that be like a simple animation or what the interaction looks like, a prototype is there as a tool to kind of test out exactly what that interaction feels like when it's on your device, without you having to worry about like technical constraints or like what the code can do at the moment. It's just simply like the purest form of the interaction and how like that feels with the user on a device itself.
Was that like the toaster demo last year? Where they showed like an iPhone controlling a toaster, and they kept showing back and forth how they made that sort of stuff work.
Yeah, guys. So I wasn't a part of that talk. I was the one that was the predecessor to it, where we were just talking about iOS prototyping.
But Mateus hiding behind the couch.
So there's a lot of smoke and mirrors to that too. So it's not necessarily like, we're going to make this code real, we're going to make this hardware real, but we're going to fake it enough so that you believe that this is the interaction that you would have if you were to use this prototype in the real world.
it's one of those things that can help you feel the happy path so that you can then get everybody on board to say, okay, this happy path is so cool, we need to make the non-happy path not terrible. Like, it's a really convenient way of saying, this is the best of the future.
Yes.
Now, so, can we make
it? I love that expression. That is the best expression.
The happy path?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's the happy path, so it sells what you're trying to do, and at the same time, you use it to test out whether the thing that you wanted to do was the correct way at the end of the day. So it's got both things to it. It's prototyping is great, guys.
Is it like getting rid of those 1,000 no's and getting closer to the yes?
Sorry, what did you say?
Like, because that famous saying, you know, we have 1,000 no's for every yes. And can prototyping get rid of a bunch of those no's for you before, so you can get closer to that yes?
Yeah, that was literally the team that I was on. It was the 1,000 no's team. The team of the 1,000 no's. That was us.
But they had a happy path. It was 1,000 no's, but a happy path. Balances.
Well, wait. So what was your role exactly? Was it like a red team kind of thing where given any prototype, you're going to be like, no, this sucks because, and here's why?
No.
Was it more of a...
We were the 1,000 yeses behind before you make the one no.
Okay.
So our team was all about saying
that's
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Our team was about saying yes to anything, saying we have an open mind to everything that could be and is a possibility in our future reality and testing out that space. So our whole entire goal was if you had an idea, like, take the Apple Pencil. If you have an idea of how to draw, you know, we would explore that entire space of like using your stylus, using your finger. What does it do? What does the ink do? What does it even mean to erase? Our team was the one to explore that holistic space and say, this is the realm of possibilities. Here is the story behind that. Make your judgments about it. You know, like there are a million different ways to go. We're going to show all of them very equally, and you can make a determination on whether like one path is better than the other. And of course, we all had our opinions at the time of like what the best way to do it was. But at the same time, like we were there to keep an open mind before everyone else decided to like come in and say, well, no, you can't do that because blah, blah, blah. And you know, like this isn't the right way of doing it, but we were the ones to have an open mind about every single possibility.
And what I would say is amazing about Linda's team and Linda's work is that it wasn't about like it wasn't purely we're trying all the things and seeing what lands. Everything that I saw come out of your team was done with such diligence and high quality, even knowing that it was probably going to wind up on the cutting room floor, right? Like I just saw so many beautiful things that were done because the exploration was absolutely worthy. And that was kind of the ethos of the team, but it wasn't just about like, let's, you know, do some diligence and then realize it's wrong and move on. Everything that I saw come out of your team was beautiful, like very thoughtfully
done. Well, thanks.
And granted, I wasn't in the team, you know, like, so I was seeing some of the things that were being shown. But what I love was that I don't think many places have a team that is exploring a lot of ideas, asking really hard questions and exploring them at high enough fidelity that they can give them to other people to have a really educated conversation.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the startling things is when people say like someone from Apple would say, we don't think we should do this. And some people think, oh, they're just being mean or cruel, or they're just being stupid. But anything that's worth trying, they've probably tried and they're doing it from an informed opinion. It's not that they're just deciding not to do it. It's that they've tried, you know, 1,000 versions that Linda's made and decided, you know, we're not doing this one right now. It's an informed decision. I think you help them get to.
And that's a hard thing to kind of communicate to the outside world too, because like you don't want to say that. You don't want to say like with Force Touch, like we explored the entirety of Force Touch and this is like all of the amazing things you can do with it. Like you want people to kind of discover that stuff on their own. And unfortunately, like it's a difficult thing to communicate because Apple is so secretive, and we only have those communications like during WWDC or like their, you know, like biannual presentations about like the fact that, you know, we did do these explorations and this was the best solution. It just looks like we came up with this all on our own.
It's effortless.
Yeah, it's effortless. It's magic.
Effortless is so much work.
It's so much work.
So one thing I wanted to ask is it Take the Pencil, mm-hmm. which I know you worked on. That's hardware in that it's a new device. It's hardware in that it needs to ship in the iPads that are going to support it. And it is software in the iPads that need to be able to communicate and get the precision data. What does that look like when you're trying to work in such a top to bottom combined team?
it's a lot of collaboration that people don't expect out of somewhere that, you know, people have heard like Apple's very siloed.
Right. That, which is why I'm asking, like,
exactly.
That seems to break like at least three or four walls of like
imaginary Apple walls.
Yeah. Well, I mean, luckily for the prototyping team, which I was the total antithesis of the experience that I had on like the iMovie was, you know, like there was a lot of cross-team collaboration. So like every single day was we would meet with hardware and then we would meet with ID and then we would meet with human interface, industrial design. And all of those teams would kind of come together constantly in all of these explorations. So like what it was really interesting about that project was it was constantly this dialogue about like the hardware constraints with like all of the future possibilities of like how someone could draw with this like beautiful idea. And it was a lot of cross collaboration that I hadn't seen in other projects that I had worked on.
So you're taking feedback from, I mean, I imagine how fast the hardware guys can track the pencil.
Mm-hmm.
Little bit feeds back into your design through software and then ultimately to the pencil, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, like it was constantly going from this kind of like very high level discussion of like what we believe the pencil to be to talking with the hardware team and talking very specifics about like the latency and like how we calculate force and what are the different sensors that we're going to integrate into this piece of hardware. And I thought that came together really, really well within the process where every single person was talking with each other and like the prototyping team became, because we were like the liaison between hardware and design, we kind of like intersected that area really, really well. So
I honestly think, and I'm not just saying this because you're on the show and that we've all been drinking, but
a little bit.
No, I think the pencil is sort of an epitome of Apple's accomplishments, like what they can do. I managed to use it. I won't say how, but before it got out, like I saw a prototype and not a prototype, but like the press units. Wow. It blew me. It blew me away. It was incredible. Just like 15 minutes playing with it. And I was amazed.
I think it's like,
I don't think you could do that given any other structure or any, and it's amazing because, the company is not set up to kind of pick those walls, but when it needs to, it can sort of integrate in a very vertical way. Was that a good experience or was it like a?
No, it was probably like the most streamlined experience I've ever had at the company, actually, was where everyone was incredibly on board with the product and like hardware was working just as fast as software was. And it was like this beautiful harmony of like, you know, making sure that these sensors always had a kind of human reason for existing. And then when we were talking about like, oh, well, like how does it draw? How is it fluid? It was always backed up by that technical component where it was like, okay, we got to make sure that this latency is perfect in order to create that sensation that you're actually drawing. And I think those two blended in so well together where I was blown away by the prototypes, like even like years before it ended up shipping. Like it was just such a wonderful thing to.
It was almost unbelievable because I used Wacom tablets for a decade and I went to the Apple Pencil event and they passed me one and I got to use it and there was no gap. There was no little reticule following after you. I tried to confuse it by going quickly and it was intelligent enough to keep up. job, and it actually felt like you were drawing on something, not that you were drawing through layers and layers of.
Mm-hmm. And that is so important. And like in design meetings, you can talk about that feeling as much as you want, but then you realize like how much effort it takes on the technical side of it to make something like that happen.
But one thing I loved about Apple is that if you talked about a feeling that you were in pursuit of, everyone respected that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of places where, or just a lot of environments where you might say, yeah, it should feel really X. It's like, yeah. Cool story, bro. That's nice. this is what we can do. And there, I mean, being embedded within an engineering organization, I saw those conversations where our engineering team was very honestly like, no, this is all we can do. And I appreciated that we, our design team and external design teams were able to question that. And that would be respected by the engineering team. I think there are very, there are some things that are fixed. Like in the case of Siri, voice recognition being perfect, I'm not holding my breath. however, like
that's a hard problem though, right?
Like, it's a really hard problem. And I appreciate that Apple is one of those places where that being maybe a more fixed constraint doesn't mean that we can't continue questioning it. And asking what we want it to be and forcing something that's great. I never felt like it was forcing against the team's will. Everybody there is intent on building a product or experience that they will be really proud to show their grandkid when they pull it out of a box in the attic.
When you throw like dialects and speech impediments and all sorts of things to it, it becomes an almost endless problem.
But it's kind of exciting. I felt like the engineering team working with them, the answer was never like, no, never, it's too hard. It was, and it would be frustrating, but good, they would be frustrating, but good conversations. It would be, okay, not right now, but here's something we can do to get in this direction. Or like, this is way too monumental for this period of time, but we agree that that would be the most amazing experience. So how do we lay groundwork for that right now? And I respect that spirit. And I don't think that a lot of places empower that spirit.
We're working towards the Siri Pencil, but it'll take us a while to get there.
Siri Pencil. Ooh, that would be awesome. Let's make that.
Right. Final work. No.
Well, one thing I know is that the input loop for the Pencil events had to be changed in that the Pencil is sampled way later in the run loop in order to provide the minimum amount of lag. Like they went out of their way to fix up the lag on the Pencil.
They did.
Yes. Like not a little bit out of the way. They went way out of the way. But anyway. So what are you guys working on now?
We're working on similar things.
We are actually.
Yeah.
Weirdly.
Do you wanna go into that?
Are you able to?
In a way.
Before you get into that, can you explain a little bit, like, because you left a big company and now you're sort of charting your own path. What is that like?
Yeah, we both did actually. We left Apple at around the same time, and both of us have been trying to kind of figure out a way to make our footprint on the world while contracting, and then kind of thinking about independent projects as well.
Did you just want a break? Did you want did you want to try doing something on a smaller scale? Or
the way I felt was so being a millennial and therefore a jerk who like doesn't appreciate the value of hard labor. I felt like I had been at Apple for about 5 or 6 years, and I wasn't convinced that I was insecure about being a company man. Like I was very I loved what Apple was capable of doing, and I loved the people I was working with, and I have not found somewhere that is working on harder problems, let alone so many hard problems at an insane scale. But I felt like I wanted to see the world and experience new things. And when I was considered, I had put in notice and it was the like, would you consider joining other teams? And one person I was talking to who was really trying to talk me into joining their team said, hey, I will say that there is one good reason to leave Apple, and it is that you do not want to be at Apple anymore. that is kind of the only good reason to leave. And I looked inward and said, you know, I kind of just want to not be at Apple. And it's not any slight on the company. If anything, I adore it more than ever not being there. But I feel like I just wanted to try something new. And with new people, I think on new problems, and find out if I actually had acquired any expertise, and then try to, you know, use it and build new skills. That was the motivation, really, was I wanted to try something new. I didn't know what I could do outside of Apple, and I wanted to find out.
They seem like a smart company, because if they think you're an all-star, they'll try to find a fit for you in another. They don't want to lose you from their team, but if they have to lose you from their team, they'd like to get you on another team. And then if they really have to lose you, they're like, well, if you come back within 2 years, like, go do your Rumspringa, and if you come back within 2 years, we'll take you back and put you on something awesome. So it seems like they're good about, like, nurturing the talent.
I mean, I would say that the answer to that is yes. I think any company, it's really hard to, I think it's impossible to track who feels like they need a Rumspringa, as you put it, or not. And how do you make them feel valued, and like, and what is the length that you will go to keep someone when you have a great brand and so many intelligent people already, like you have this incredible momentum. I don't think that Apple makes their first order of business keeping you around. Like, I know some companies in the value do. I think Apple respects that at some point it might not be the right fit for you. And like, yes, if you feel like it might be, we want you to come back. And if you don't, we'll be fine. So I think Apple, like any company, talent development and retention is really hard. I think that they care about keeping good people, even if it's also hard for them to do. How would you feel?
I agree with you on a lot of points. Unfortunately for me, what kind of happened was that there was like a diversity issue that we see in the rest of the industry that really affected me during my time there. And because it wasn't handled in a suitable manner while I was an employee, I kind of decided, like, alongside other things of like wanting to like do my own thing and like being more in the games industry, I did feel that pressure of not feeling extremely supported, because you're right, like Apple has a million smart people around, and you know, like what's the loss of like one smart person? But like, unfortunately for me, like that happened to be me at the time, and it was because of those diversity issues. And I just decided that it was not the healthiest environment for, you know, my current state, and so I decided to leave at that point, which is a very unfortunate story, and it's a story that I hear repeated throughout the entire tech industry, and it sucks being like one more statistic, but it's something that I had to do.
So the diversity issues, because you're left-handed, is that it?
Yes, it's because I was left-handed.
Are you?
No,
she's not. No. I'm just going to guess. That's really unfortunate. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I'm sorry too. I mean, like, you see all these companies, like they've all released their kind of diversity numbers throughout the years. And you're realizing that like Twitter and Apple, like they release their numbers, and they say that they're going to take the steps to kind of move that forward, move the dial forward. But, you know, as evidenced by the retention numbers, it's not necessarily the case.
Hiring diverse candidates is very different than retaining them.
Exactly.
So actually, it's interesting. I was hired into Apple as an intern on a diversity initiative. Apple was hiring students from all women's colleges and historically black colleges and universities at a level that was really unprecedented. And I went to Wellesley, which is an all women's college. Normally Apple would recruit at MIT and Harvard if they were in our neck of the woods. And it just so happened that they, this 1 year or for 2 years, came and visited us. And that was actually because a professor at a school that was both a historically black college and an all women's college had been visiting Apple's campus. He brought his all black, all women's robotics team for a competition out there. And it was actually on Steve's request that he took time off, did a sabbatical, and helped them with recruiting for more diverse people. It was awesome. I would say that we were friends with like 90% of like diverse people at Apple. And as a consequence of that, and so many, like everybody from our class is doing really impressive things. Two people are still at Apple.
Two of them. Yes.
So
out of a group of like, I want to say 30 or 40 plus that we're extremely like tight knit and like, we're still very close.
Retention is a hard problem, and I don't think I think that it's not just around diversity. I think it's really hard. I worked on so at Apple we had a group called so obviously we had like women at Apple. There are a lot of diversity network associations, and Women at Apple was one of them. I helped start one called Women at Apple Tech, specifically focusing on technical women at Apple. And so one of the things that we did try to increase retention was to put on, this was like my baby, but to put on what we call tech talks, where female engineers at Apple could speak about their technical work at Apple, anything that, you know, was safe to discuss internally. And we gave them the stage that the iPod was announced on in town hall. And so we would like fill up these auditoriums with like, actually it was, talks by women for everyone. And so these auditoriums we filled with like 300 plus people, and it was awesome. And it was this tiny stage to be able to talk about your work, because when you, especially when you are a diverse, like, I don't say diversity candidate, but someone who really needs to know that your work is valued.
Yeah.
And you are not allowed to go outside the company for that validation. It was just one attempt to try to increase retention of these people who contribute so much and are really not known. So it was really interesting to see this turn from some of the people we would host going from being another person in the workforce, completely unknown, having been there for, you know, like 20 or more years, to being kind of a celebrity on campus. And I think that's one effort, but it's a really insignificant effort compared to how much work needs to be done to retain really talented people who are not like a huge amount of your really talented people.
So, I mean, I've been saying for years that retention is among Apple's biggest, I don't want to say threats, but like, I mean, like if Apple's going to fail, it's because they can't retain talent.
Really. I don't know. They can attract really good talent, though.
Well, for a little bit. But I mean, at some point, Microsoft could too, right? And now they can't. What could be done better to retain the talent or to encourage more internal diversity? And this is super not a topic I expected to discuss today. So I've done no research on it, but now that we're down that avenue, I want to kind of address it. What could have been done in order to make you feel more comfortable or to multiply the effectiveness of these talks in town hall that you were giving?
Talks in town hall were like a nice like feel good platform. I think God, that is really minimizing the effort, like and the intent of the work. But like, but being realistic, it was really a great way of giving people a platform, but it doesn't scale especially well. We, you know, we all had full-time jobs and wanted to focus on being great at those jobs and also focus each talk very clearly on a topic. So it's not many people, there's not a lot of throughput, and it was hard. I think this isn't specific to Apple. I think this is just for any company. Really?
No. Yeah. I'm using Apple as the framework.
For sure.
We can all kind of explore this. But
so I was talking to someone who is head of design at a well-known company in the Bay Area, and they were saying that when they joined the company, they realized that the people who were being paid very well were not necessarily the most high output people. They were the most famous people.
Yes.
And they kind of said, like, in their tenure, they wanted to focus on making things more fair. And they recognized very easily and early that the people who were being paid less but offering more tended to be candidates who had been hired in at a lower salary, and those tended to be candidates who were not white, cis, hetero men.
Mm-hmm.
So who had gone to Stanford or MIT or Caltech. So I think that the biggest thing you can do is actually care and be incentivized by your company to look at fairness in pay and in opportunity and in promotions. And I think that the idea that the Valley or any industry is highly meritocratic is loaded and is not quite accurate, because some of the most high output people I saw were also some of the most under-recognized, because it was like, oh, you just like are great, as opposed to, oh, wow, you're working really hard. And yeah, oh my God, like 90% of your team is being paid 200% more than you. What can we do to level that out? I think some companies work really hard to do leveling, like, very wisely. I think
Do you have any examples?
I've heard that YouTube does a really good job of this, or did at one point do a really good job of this.
So they spend their effort on that rather than the comments, because I'm all for that. If they want to police that rather than the comments, go for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. But actually, under their VP of product at one point, they went through and said, okay, like, what are these levels? Do these actually correlate to the work that these people are doing? And they radically re-leveled everyone. And I don't know if they're doing that on an ongoing basis, but that's one company that I know at one point under, it was Shishir Marota, who's now working on a startup of his own.
Was that pre or post acquisition?
Post acquisition. So this is like within Google, he kind of went through and said, okay, something seems off. And then made it his job and his priority to change that. And I think to some extent, I don't know about his popularity, but I know that there probably aren't a lot of companies or execs where people are told, hey, you should definitely pay all of the great people a lot more, and all the people who get us publicity, you should probably fire because they're paid too much. Like, that doesn't, I don't know that that's what happened at YouTube. I will say that's not what happens at many companies. It's not like very incentivized.
Well, I don't even know if that kind of thing exists. If we go back to Apple, I don't know if like a whole like celebrity status versus like her working status
exists.
That's
very true, because celebrities are not like the hotness at Apple.
Right.
No, you get
you got
fired.
Dr. Dre, and then you got everybody else.
I love you. Boss St. John.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah, but she's a beat.
She killed it. She's perfect.
Oh my God, she killed it. She's like a beats acquisition. That's her job, right?
Like everything that like I always wanted out of like a mentor at Apple, like someone I could actually look up to who just like kicks ass and doesn't care and
hang out with.
Confident.
I have heard that from so many women who do work and have worked at Apple. They're like, oh my God, she's the best.
It a part of it really is like having that type of mentorship and having that like even like an idol to kind of look up to, like for the idols that I could look up to at the time, like Eddie Q.
I want to be her.
Yeah, but there are a bunch of like
middle-aged white guy. I'm like, I'd rather be her.
So I want to my utmost compliment of a woman is that she's a bad bitch. And I feel like there's some bad bitch lady executives at Apple. That's not a formal term. You won't see that like on Apple's website. But so for example, like Cheryl Thomas demoed at WDC. She's so cool. I like want to be her when I grow up. Mm-hmm. She was also very supportive of these talks of women at Apple Tech. She's a hustler. She's been at Apple for like 20 plus years. And there are really badass female, like, lady leaders at Apple. And
she did the Playgrounds demo, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But, like, a lot of – and she's amazing. She is – I think it's, like, VP of software operations. She's so hardcore. And there are a lot of really impressive, cool women, but they also have been there for, like, 20 years. And they are, like, three levels your grand boss. And if you don't have one in your executive chain, it's not even like you feel comfortable reaching out and saying, hey, I want to be you when I grow up. Can we hang out? Like,
yeah.
And Cheryl is one of those people who would be open to that kind of outreach. But how would you know? She's just so incredible. It's
so
really
what do you what do you think about the Grace Hopper Conference?
It's cool. I went a few times.
Yeah, you've gone.
Yeah.
And now that's a little bit of a veer, but Apple sent a lot of
women and
people to the conference last year. And it is, just for the audience, it is, I mean, how would you describe it? It's a collection of women in technology.
Yeah, Grace Hopper was a badass computer scientist who wrote the first compiler and like came up.
She's a rear admiral. She's like a badass in everything.
Every all things. She's the person who coined the term a bug because there was a literal moth in the computer.
Really think that like Grace Hopper could pick up the phone and launch a nuclear missile. Like nobody would ask her. Like,
coolest lady of all time. The conference is for specifically for women in computer science. Historically, it had been a lot of like academics trying to figure out what to do like in academia in their lives, but specifically as women in computer science. I went a few times with Apple to Grace Hopper, and what I loved about it, and I've heard even since leaving. Going to Grace Hopper Conference is about meeting other women at Apple. And it's about like, and that opportunity to be in one space and have conversations that are both honoring the fact that you were chosen to be there. You're technically like, being there is being acknowledged that like you are hustling at Apple and we are grateful that you're here and we want to invite you to some other hustlers. It just felt like a high powered women at Apple networking group when I didn't know that all of those people existed. And so that I think is really cool.
So does that short circuit what you were saying about like I don't
feeling like you can
feel
reach
comfortable
out
like reaching way up the chain?
No, totally, yeah, because you're like seeing Isabel Mahe, who's VP of wireless, just chilling in the lobby of your hotel, and you feel like you can go over and say, "Oh my God, you're my hero!" And she actually like this is a context where that's not only invited, but it's like. It's not really safe, but it's invited.
It's kind of why you're all there, right?
Right, to foster this community and opportunity for women to help other women. That said, that's one event a year, and it's
At the same time, it's a great safe space in order to like have those discussions and like meet those people. But at the same time, like you're going back into an environment where you're still the minority and you're still maybe like one of the only people who kind of think in this way.
Yeah.
And to bring that point of view and say like, I went to this conference and it was amazing to a bunch of people who might not understand that.
Or how important it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Like it's hard to kind of like bring those lessons back into a team, especially when you might be the most junior person on the team like I was, and say like, things need to change. And they come back and maybe say, well, you're the only one who's saying that. Like, maybe things don't need to change. Maybe it's just you.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes a very hard dialogue. And it's a dialogue that I know a bunch of people are going through within the entire industry. And it's kind of like, how do you set yourself up so that you can kind of like re-educate all the members of your team about like what might be the good ways of organizing, like how you do things or how you talk.
Send them to Grace Hopper for the weekend.
Right?
Well, and so Apple has started doing that. It's not just going to Grace Hopper from Apple.
No, sorry. Yeah. It's a broader thing. Also, I don't think you want to flood Grace Hopper with a bunch of men because it
tactically
kind of like defeats the purpose a little bit, you know.
It encouraged allyship. I don't think it was like
I don't mean to
you don't want it to be like we're sending more men to women to Grace Hopper this year because like men are great at computer science, they should go to a computer science conference. Like that would be terrible.
If it was representative of the industry, I think that would.
Well, and that's like what I think is
90% dudes and with 10% women.
That's kind of why Grace Hopper was also fun. Is you're like, oh, so this is what it's like. Yeah. This would be sweet. Why aren't we the ruling class of computer science? Like this.
I mean, we were.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. So why? How do we get that back? Yeah. Anyway.
Because we're just smarter. That's all.
So I diverted this whole topic. What is it like to be indie now, or at least to be doing contract work?
It's great.
It's super fun.
It's awesome.
It's super fun. People, I don't know. They're really nice and they're so happy you're there.
I actually think it's like just really awesome, like both of us being at Apple for so long and us not being able to talk about it. Like when you go into a contract gig and you get to kind of like be an evangelist for the way we work, the way we prototype, the way we design, and people are very excited about that. Like I think that's awesome. And it's a position of power that we were never able to have while we were working at Apple.
And I love seeing more process, like different people's process. Yeah. So I think on your team, you had a bunch of ex-agency folks. I had never worked in an agency before. And right now I'm working with a team that's mostly ex-IDEO. And I, like when we were interns, Linda and I went to a talk and someone from IDEO was speaking. And so that I was in my Hermione Granger phase. I just was sucking up to everybody. and so I went up to this guy, like, hey, can we get a tour of IDEO? I'll bring a bunch of Apple interns.
It was great.
It's good for you.
IDEO, just for the listener, is a down design firm. Like, they are top notch.
Yes.
Top notch, design thinking, very holistic.
Right. Yeah. Inform a lot of the coursework.
In terms of physical products, like not.
They do a bunch of.
They do it all.
They do it all.
They're so cool, and okay. They're now.
I'm a fan of purely their physical stuff, which is like.
Sure, sure.
Can you give us some examples, like stuff that people might know?
Well, the IKEA like push trolleys.
The IKEA push trolleys. A folding bicycle.
Okay, now I'm going to be a jerk.
They did so much stuff. Like
sometimes I confuse them with frogs, so I hope I'm not.
Right, that's why like, I'm like.
No, I know, but also, one of the first mice, if not the first mouse, they did the Palm Pilot. Like they did a bunch of stuff that was ahead of its time and very well considered that maybe we look back on now and say, ugh, like, why have we moved on? Why do we have iPads? But when you think of the foresight and the thought and consideration given to these things they've worked on. I mean, those are some of the more historical examples.
For IDEO, though, they
worked for a reason. Like,
what's that?
Palm Pilot worked for a reason. You can compare it to your Apple phone from 15 years later, but
right,
shut up. Like, it was amazing for what it was, you know?
IDEO really like sold themselves on, like, they became very famous for selling this idea of design thinking. Mm-hmm. So, which,
I feel like the downside is that people don't understand that being a designer does not mean going to a designer.
Requires work?
I think it sort of obfuscates the work of design to some folks who do not do that, like are not in that craft. They're like, oh no, but like, I get it. Like design thinking, but benefits of design thinking as a philosophy is that you can go into a conversation and speak more of a common language when you're describing the result of your craft. And I think that is the plus side of design thinking. What I will say is working with these folks from IDEO is so cool for me. I'd always thought that I was missing out by never having worked at an agency, but I also recognized that when you work in an agency, you work long hours for not a lot of pay. So it was this like, how do I learn to think this way? And how do I meet some of the fantastic people who come out of agencies, given that they weren't on my design teams at Apple? And working with this group is awesome. I like am understanding that Post-it notes are actually functional, whereas I always thought they were a joke about stereotypical designers.
Post-it notes are great.
Post-it notes are the bomb. Don't let anybody tell you anything else. And like, I'm benefiting so much from being exposed to other people's way of doing work. And I am loving it. I think the other big benefit of being indie is just like meeting new people. Apple is kind of a closed network. Not many people do leave Apple. I mean, a lot of my favorite people at Apple are still there and will be there for a while until I can poach them away to work on something really, really cool. And it would have to be so cool to poach them. So I love meeting new people. It's a great environment for that.
Yeah, the whole like seeing other people's point of view is so fascinating. Like I disagree with 90% of what I see, but it's really interesting kind of getting that perspective. And like a huge reason for why I quit was because I wanted to travel for a year. And a big portion of that, like not just because like, blah, 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 millennial, like I want to like go see the world, whatever, was the idea that people from everywhere else have such a different idea of how how technology fits into their lives mm-hmm. and like what they do with their everyday lives, which I found absolutely fascinating mm-hmm. That I can hopefully bring back to Silicon Valley and our little weird tech bubble and say like, you know, maybe this isn't the right way of thinking about it. You know, maybe.
But yeah, I just went on my first work research trip ever. I had done user research when at Apple and like occasionally and used data and research to make design decisions to some extent. But it was awesome. I was in Miami last week. I got bitten by like 3,000 mosquitoes. And I also talked to all these really interesting people about their pain points with certain experiences. And then went back to an Airbnb where me and two designers who I really admire just like sat down and forced ourselves to think through things with so much rigor as a collaborative team. And I at Apple always was in groups where I would be a lone wolf and more or less owning the design of a thing and occasionally having touch points where I'm selling people on the fact that like I might have the right idea. But working in a collaborative environment and doing research in the field, it's all stuff that I know I would not be doing at Apple right now. And it's just a different process. Neither is necessarily better, but it's so cool to have exposure to different people, different ways of doing work. And also traveling is an amazingly cool thing to integrate into how you think about the world. Like there are other people in it. It's awesome.
There are other people in this world.
No way. They're not just all in San Francisco. Montreal, for example.
That's a myth. Montreal's totally a myth.
I know. I didn't believe that you guys were there. I thought you guys were here.
Montreal is pretty awesome.
I've been once.
I've been once too. It's great.
A lot of French everywhere. McGill University.
Yes.
McGill.
Yeah.
Super cold, but very clean.
Yeah.
Super cold. It's cold in the winter. Right now, it's really
you
hot.
You got to come up. We'll take you for a good dinner, and then we'll take you out for poutine.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect, because we're going to do that.
The poutine soaks up the booze, so it's a beautiful relationship.
Right.
Love poutine. Yeah.
It's an equilibrium.
Yes. You know.
Okay.
What's the future? What do you see happening in the next 10 years that sort of changes your perspective on the way that you design and develop projects and solutions for the companies that you're working for or for yourselves? You can pour another glass of wine. Just pour another glass of wine. So,
and you can't say Siri pencil.
What the listeners don't know is that we're actually on video chat and like...
You see us both swigging sangria simultaneously?
No, there was a confused look there. And I know it's a dumb question. But
it's the most important question, actually.
I have no smart answers.
You know, I think Leah and I actually talk about this all the time. Like, whether it's through dumb shit, like, you know, we have an idea for a VR dating app.
It was a really good idea.
It was a really good idea.
I just bought an Oculus so we can prototype it. I just wanted to say, guys, I feel like a jerk.
I'm because that's going to just turn into porn really quick.
Oh, no. You guys, there is already VR porn.
Hey, you don't have to tell me.
All right, good. In the know. No, but it's funny. I am both so excited about quote unquote the future, but also very hesitant to believe that something being futuristic also will make it good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Like, I think that's what we saw with Google Glass is it's like, oh my God, augmented reality, the future, it's here. How awesome.
It's stuck on my face.
Right. And instead everyone was like, oh, you're a jerk. You have too much money. You're not respecting my privacy. I don't know if you're filming me or not. Like, there were all of these really interesting social and cultural things that needed to be overcome before we could evaluate whether or not Google Glass was a good idea.
Yeah,
and so
it's like every time I go on a date.
Yeah, I think.
It's all a date.
Yes, totally. Right. But so I feel like a Luddite because when I'm looking at things that people are investing in, for example, there's a lot of, oh my God, artificial intelligence. Oh my God, like chatbots. Oh my God, VR, AR, Internet of Things.
If machine people are learning.
And I just feel like we're at this exciting point where there are all these nascent technologies that could work together in this really cool, fancy way. But we're also at a point where you see society and culture. There are a lot of interesting hurdles there. And additionally, we're at a point where The holders of the data that can create really beautiful experiences do not want to share it. And then you also see the holders of the data have a huge amount of responsibility possibly to their customers. I, working on Siri, would sometimes feel hamstrung by wanting to stick by Apple's principles of really respecting customers' privacy, because you can do so much cool stuff if you don't care. Yeah. If you don't, right? If you don't care, you can make the coolest stuff ever. But yeah. Apple really, really cares. As somebody working there, it was just like saying, hey, this isn't good enough, or like, hey, this is what that we want the experience to be, you guys. The latency needs to be better, holds a lot of weight. So it is saying, hey, we don't want this on our service, or like, we don't want to possibly compromise our customers.
Was that more like a handcuff, or sort of the way the river was flowing?
Like
one being an artificial restriction and the other being the nature of the thing.
I would say that it was very much core to Apple's ethos as I experienced it. I do not believe that we will see really crazy experiences with Apple devices that would require they possibly compromise users' data. And so I think like differential privacy was something that came up at WWDC, right? Like, how can we be really innovative about trying to distribute knowledge of things so that we don't have it, but you can have a beautiful experience? And I think that that is the route that Apple goes with that, is we need it to be safe.
You keep saying we.
Well, no, I'm an...
I know. Well, it's awesome. The only reason I'm bringing that up is because people are going to be listening, and I want to make clear that you're no longer
right.
there.
Right, no, I don't work but, there. Yeah, because if I did, I would be murdered.
But ex-Apple people speak like that all the time.
It's true. It took me a year to stop saying we. And I had to find
It'll take a while. But yeah, you're totally right.
I actually don't feel too much shame about it. I feel pretty bonded with like we as the collective people that I'm friends with who are still there kind of fighting these fights. It's like all of us are still united in our principles. And so that is one of those principles that is very important. So anyway,
that's
one
thing. I meant more about like the way the river goes, like the nature of the thing is like.
The nature of that company is to be very thoughtful about its customers. And so, and then there's the other part of the nature of that company, which is to not like, you know, be kind of like having all of the cards and not necessarily sharing them with others. So that's the piece where it's like, we have all of these devices and services that are learning more about you, and with their powers combined, wouldn't it be so awesome? We could do all the things, but the incentives of companies to do that are not really there right now. And so I don't know where we'll be in 10 years. I want to say like, everything would be cool. And then like my this will know everything about that and will make me really happy. And then I'll like look out onto the skyline and I'll see what time the sunset's going to happen. And, you know, like, I don't know how much is possible combined with like when you consider bureaucracy, technology, companies and their personal interests. And then companies trying to either do the right thing by their customers or compromise that, which is a bigger issue in society and culture. Anyway, I have no idea. 10 years from now, no clue. Those are some
good. That's good. That's the kind of answer that makes me happy.
Just ask Linda. She's prototyping it right now.
Yeah, Linda knows though. You should ask Linda.
Right now, if you were to pan the camera left, she'd have the future on her on the table.
It's Wally.
Hey guys.
I hear you've got some beans. Wally. You want to spill those or like?
No, not really. I mean, it's difficult because I actually get this question a lot,
you're contractually obligated to not answer it
for a really long time. Like that was my job, was to kind of figure out like what does our future look like in the next 10 years, and so obviously I can't really try to want to hint or try to speak to any of the things that Apple was trying to do in that field.
Mm-hmm.
I guess
do we have an army of Donald Trump robots marching around shooting everybody?
But they're very well elegant.
That was my pet project, actually.
The Trump bots.
Yo, I'm still waiting for Kanye 2020, guys.
Yeah.
Basically, at this point, Let's do it.
If Zuckerberg would give him that $1 billion, we'd have it right now.
Oh, it's true. Well, in the meantime, Linda and I just every week send Kanye our resume so that we can work on Donda and his creative lab. And then we're thinking,
I would actually be okay with that.
I would definitely work for
Kanye. Would be the perfect vessel to form any type of political idea that you would have.
I would definitely work for Donda. I feel like Kanye is like a dad figure, maybe the way Steve was. I don't, who knows?
He's kind of like a ventriloquist. Like, I feel like I could shape Kanye in the way that like Sarah Palin was shaped.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So anyway, we'll see.
So Linda, you're not escaping this.
Oh God.
No, I'm going to hold you to it. Yeah, and you don't have to answer. But I mean, do you 5 to 10 years? What's the game?
Completely disassociated with anything that I was doing at Apple. Like I would love to see more things in the future completely disassociated with visuals and completely disassociated with our concept of screens. So
you guys are kind of teamed up on that.
in
a way.
I'm going to wind up running everything or battling each other for dominance at some point. So stay tuned.
I come from an industrial design background. I care about the physicality. I care about the real world. And that is a huge part of like where I see the future headed was like we use screens as this kind of bandage, as a stepping stone between us and reality. And we did a really good job with that. And I think there is an ability for us to kind of transcend those types of interactions. And so people are talking about that right now in terms of like AR or like VR or any of that stuff, but like those are all technologies, like whatever, like they can exist, but like the theme of the entire thing is like, how do we make sure that every single one of our everyday objects is extremely designed for like the way that we interact for our situation, and being like very contextually aware of like what we're doing. And I'm sure that was the initial goal of like this whole Internet of Things movement, and obviously the Internet of Things has turned into this kind of like sideshow circus. I don't know.
We had that in the 90s too, right?
Yeah.
It's a cyclical thing, right?
Exactly. So it's like 3D movies. We're just going to keep going back to it and it's just going to get weirder. I care about emotion a lot. So like creating emotional bonds between you and like the world around you. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I resonate with how video games are treating, interaction design right now, because like they are creating that emotional tie between you and a physical object or you and the screen that a user interface just isn't doing right now. And that's why I want to get into that industry, because I see them kind of paving the way for like the future of how we interact with things versus like app design.
Yeah,
that's kind of my background. And yeah, like the feedback loop of playing a game helps you learn the rules of the system.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways. It's hard to map back to, you know, I don't know, using web browser. Like I don't know how that plays back into it. But yeah, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the way that people naturally pick up games and internalize them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just like everything you did as a kid growing up, learning like your life lessons about how the world works, like that was a game. And
we discovered recently that both of us got into design and coding because we were really into Neopets and like when you realize that
Neopets?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Hey Renee, cut the feed.
No.
No, and so when you realize that some of the games you play as kids are what make the four of us have this conversation right now is interesting. Like how can we create these accidental
The guy was a Tamagotchi person, so he's not gonna stand for Neopets.
That's why.
Tamagotchi.
Yeah, you guys are GoBot fans, and I'm a Transformer man.
College guys.
Oh, I did too.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had those newer ones.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, I bought that.
Sick, you guys.
I
And now I have Neko Atsume. Actually,
it's been a while. I have Hatch that's still alive.
Oh, you still have Hatch?
I do have Hatch.
That was the David Lanham thing, right?
It was the...
Phil Ryu and David Lanham.
Yeah, Phil Ryu.
Anyway, so I don't know.
Virtual the guy's Pat. Going back to Chia Pet right now, and it's landing hard.
Yeah.
My head is turning into a Chia Pet at this point.
Are you not a Neopets fan?
Yeah, what is this?
Yeah, what? I don't understand.
I'm an old man. I don't know. Yeah, they're fine. That's cool.
They're fine, you guys? Get out of here. Get out of here.
It's my show. If anybody's going to keep coming off of my show, it should be you guys.
Totally.
Renee, have you tried the breathing mechanism in Watch OST?
I have. So my best friend, Georgia, she's a therapist. And one of the first things she does in any one of her sessions is teach breathing. And the watch thing just nails. I mean, it's not exactly what she does, but it is so close to it. And it can do it on a scale that, you know, not everybody goes and learns about breathing and learns about mindfulness. And just putting that in an app, to me, it's one of the miraculous things about the Apple Watch, like all those things, the stand things and the motivational things, to me, that's, you know, it's a noble endeavor. I'm super happy they did it.
Yeah.
I want to see more of that.
I think it's cool.
Yeah. I want to see us like move past utilitarian things and do things that like help us in like, the physical or mental world.
Something I liked that you just said, Linda, earlier was it's not about, it's not about the technology, right? It's about helping us interface with the world better, not helping us interface with our devices better. I feel like devices are, they're a piece of the puzzle, but I think they should just be serving our better, our more grandiose interests about who we want to be and how we want to live. And when I think about things like autonomous cars, I'm not excited because, I'm not excited only because like, sweet, cool future. I'm really in like concept car videos that are terrible. I'm really excited because I think about the amount of parents who spend like 6 hours a day in their car, shuttling their kids between activities instead of actually having a moment to themselves. I get excited because I think that technology at its best can, I think the idea of creating more leisure time, it's always the pursuit of like, societies, but
labor saving machines.
But, right, I know, which is like controversial in and of itself. But I think that there is what technology can do at its best is get out of the way and get things out of our way so that we can actually connect as people and like have experiences that are very tangible. And I don't know,
it's the idyllic Star Trek vision where it eliminates all the mundane things and it just lets you live a life of discovery and pursuit.
Right. Discovery and pursuit, I think,
they're awesome. Lofty goals and they sound like kind of a little bit pretentious, but like,
and I recognize that there are some class issues there, right?
Yeah.
Because like, I'm from New York and there was that legislation so that it would be like all fast food workers pay $15 an hour by, I think it's maybe 2018 or 2020. And so I thought that was really awesome. I thought that was great. And then I recently saw a lot of people posting on the internet, like, this is what you get when you naively think that fast food workers are going to be paid $15 an hour. And it was like machines taking orders, right? And so there's this issue of, I don't want machines to take all of the work or take all of the opportunities for like social and economic like mobility, but I would like for them to help all of us do our best work as opposed to work that is necessary just to survive. And that sounds very idealistic, but that's kind of what I'm excited about. Like, can we maybe make cool futuristic things, but not make them for their own sake, make them for our sake?
Tools.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess.
What's that theory that we spent all these years
rather than like a replacement, just better tools.
Tools.
Yeah.
We spent all these years building technology up now.
Some fingers there, which was kind of awesome. I did want to, like, you know, with regards to what Linda said earlier, I think it's remarkable, or at least interesting, that on our computers and our phones, we describe software in terms of windows onto the data. And the reality is, like, you don't want to be in a window. You want to kind of walk through a door and have a larger exploration of that. And I don't necessarily mean that that means AR or VR or anything like that. But integrating computer intelligence or just computers into everyday life seems like a worthwhile goal, rather than simply seeing it through a window or, you know, what happens to be on your phone or what Siri can pop up for you or, you know, whatever the next, or God help us, like the Google Glasses thing. I think that there's better ways to use technology than to simply project windows through which we can interact with a larger world.
Right. I agree. I think we're taking baby steps to that. Like, I think we're like, we throw around this word empathy, right? And half the time we don't even know what the hell that means. But it's this whole entire thing where, like, you're just living your life and technology happens to kind of augment your experience in that versus anything else. And I think that's, like, a really interesting space to think in.
I've stopped considering Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. They are certainly technology companies, but are they technology in terms of the way people think about them? I don't think so. I think people think about them like the phone system or like.
I think like at one
like,
point
like
they
mail,
were.
Like physical yeah. mail.
Like know? Infrastructure.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Like at one point they were. At one point they like helped us connect with the rest of the world. Like
now they're a utility.
And now we know how to do that. And now we can take a step further.
It's optimistic.
Wait, why?
No, I just mean like looking at the future as a way that it can enable human endeavors is an optimistic outlook. Because the opposite is like Judgment Day, Terminator, Matrix.
No, this is a thing that I've read somewhere and I paraphrase all the time because I don't actually remember where I read it or what it was. But anybody who has worked on complex systems and artificial intelligences knows not to be worried about Skynet in their lifetime is how I feel. Like having worked on Siri, I am not worried about the computer takeover. I mean, I am concerned about people deploying computers in ways that take over labor that like, you know, people who actually need resources, unlike computers do.
But I'm sorry. Did you mean commuter turnover?
I'm not worried about computer takeover right now, but I'm excited if it happens. I'm also not really worried about or excited about the singularity. Interesting. I don't know, betting all of my Bitcoins.
Oh, thank God. Cause that was the dumbest idea I've ever heard.
I need to, from a smart guy,
but I mean,
we're all simulations anyway, guy. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's fine.
So dumb.
I don't spend a lot of energy thinking about the singularity. How do you feel?
I don't either. I mean, like on the prototyping team, we constantly had these like morality questions, but at the same time, we were just like, okay, there's a time and place to think about morality. Let's just kind of like put that aside for a second and see like what good we can do with this. And if the good doesn't outweigh the bad, then obviously we won't go through with it. But like being so terrified of like all of these like
computers,
like
danger.
Scary.
Should the pencil be made out of Nerf material in case some kid hits his other kid with it?
Right, exactly. Like that's all fear based. Like,
yeah.
What?
And at least in the initial phases of design, I would say let's not be worried about fear. But before we ship something, let's be pretty worried
about fear.
Yeah, yeah, let's be really worried about what we're doing and why. And But singularity, I don't know. Ray Kurzweil.
No,
I'm
a smart guy, but like.
I haven't read Age of Spiritual Machines. It's a book that has like the most beautiful title on the planet, but I don't know. I couldn't do it. Yeah,
it just doesn't make sense.
The thing is,
AI is 10 years away, which is what they said in like 19.
It's always coming, but never arriving.
Exactly. Also, I just like being a physical being who does stuff. Like, I don't know.
Don't even get me started. If you put me in a robot body, I'm going to murder so many people.
Guy, are you not into VR right now?
I'm not into VR.
Maybe.
Except for VR.
Well, less so. Nobody gets hurt. If you put me in a robot body and made me want to live forever, I may just go crazy. I'm pretty sure I'd go crazy.
Really?
I, for one, am actually excited for my avatar mech life.
Oh, I like that. But I really like...
Maybe you can put me down before I hurt people.
Oh, in a micros. I was using the Vive and the Oculus yesterday. They're a lot of fun. I mean, they're incredibly interesting environments and very different because in the Vive, you're in a room moving around, standing up. You're holding on to things, so you have hand movement. Where the Oculus, like you kind of more sit down or stand there, and the world moves around you, which is right. A very different sort of orbital space and just the contrast. Yeah. And it feels like that's where we were 10 years ago with smartphones. It's the frontier, and people are making mistakes and questioning things and doing really interesting work. And that's sort of like the exciting part of it because not all the questions are answered yet.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I am interested in VR and AR.
Come over and play the lightsaber game, guy. You'll be hooked.
I just don't want to be a robot. Don't turn me into a robot.
I did see your video about that.
Wait, yeah, it's so fun.
Okay. What do you guys think about strapping random giant things to your faces and like looking like goofballs?
And you just had a talk about this.
Yeah, kind of. I don't know. It was semi about this. I talked about weird technology and I'm excited about it at Layers Conference. But what I actually wanted to do is I haven't done this, is like film myself trying to do things I actually would want to do with VR with a huge headset strapped to my face. So for example, like, okay, VR, that's cool. What if I could simulate working out with a trainer and be way less expensive? Like if I were to try to do mountain climbers with a thing strapped to my face, I would like have neck pain and like it would fall off my face and I'd lose $1,000 from this. Right. Like, I feel
it's also
like
weird because you're not feeling what you're seeing. And that sort of is what causes the vertigo because your ears aren't responding the same way your eyes are.
There's this dissonance. And I feel like I
love VR and
I like it as an escape, but I also like books.
So that's the thing. Like
books are totally VR.
Books are VR.
They're just internal instead of external.
She just wants a physical trainer.
Totally. Guys, I do have a trainer, and he is a 6'3" gymnast, and we do handstands.
Yeah, right?
And it's awesome. Why would I trade that for strapping something to my face?
Okay.
His Instagram is also amazing.
Well, the thing on your head lowers your center of gravity, making the handstand easier. Is all.
I would like to point out that Leah is much more of an extrovert than I am.
What?
I think.
Oh, you want to, like, hide in your VR and, like...
Yeah, well, for me, like, right now, like, the entire world is about, like, sharing, and let's share everything, and social, and friends, and everything, and for someone I can't handle that. Like, I need my private space, I need some place to escape, I need a meditative zone, and, like, that's what VR gives
me. It's an environment just for you,
and
inhabited just by you.
I'm so into that. Like, if we could just focus as an industry on just, like, what the private experience is, and it doesn't have to be sexy times, it could be, like, something else, like... The breathing on a watch, like I think that's so powerful.
Zen garden, a virtual Zen garden.
Exactly, like the assumption that we always want to share things all the time and be social, and that's like the end all be all of interaction.
It's funny. So Oculus's Vimeo experience is really cool. Has anybody here tried it?
Yeah.
Right. So you're like sitting on a log surrounded by toadstools, and then like you're technically in this chat room where other people might sit down with you. And my fiance was saying, so I the VR headset arrived while I was traveling for work, and he was like, yeah, I was like sitting around on this log in the middle of a bunch of toadstools, and then like these two guys from the Netherlands showed up and like we talked for a little bit, and like they were 19 and I said I was 27, and they like thought it was weird, and it was weird, but like it was really cool. It's the future. And it was kind of funny because he was really excited about this private world he was in, but did like that people showed up, but it was abstract enough that it still felt like an amazing, magical thing that happened.
There's a pool game on the Vive where you're actually playing pool and people from all over the world can play with you. And it's strange because you try to lean on the table and you fall down. But otherwise, it actually seems like you're in an international pool hall.
Yeah. No, it's interesting, but I'm also intrigued because for me, I'm like, oh, it seems like you're separating yourself from the world, but then the fact that you are inhabiting it kind of with other people is interesting. I haven't experienced that yet. I've been going into the Vimeo rooms and there's nobody in them, which is amazing. It's like that phase of the technology.
Early days.
Early days.
Did any of you guys do Second Life? Because I did.
No. Yeah.
A day?
I wasn't good at it. I don't know. It was hard. World of Warcraft was easier. Tell me about Second Life.
Dungeons.
That's a long conversation.
It's a very
the
long
sex
conversation.
Dungeons of Second Life? Is that going to be this podcast talk?
No. I didn't use it much, but I mean, it's I'm connected enough to the video game world that I had a good sense of it, and it's a second life. I don't know what to tell you. Like, people do what people do.
Minecraft is
without any constraints. That
yeah, Second Life is very hedonistic, whereas Minecraft I think is much less than that.
8 to 14-year-olds. Like my,
it's a good word for it.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I have a family member who is I think 10 now, and he and I have been playing Minecraft occasionally, and it's like it's amazing this whole world that reminds me of Second Life, but is so much less creepy.
Yeah,
so many more children under 10.
Yes.
And yet safe, I think. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Linda looks like she's had some serious scarring in seconds.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
It's the griefers. The griefers.
They showed up as an orc female, and I don't know. You'd think the crazy teeth would turn people off, but it did not work.
No, some of those orc females. No, it's the troll females who are good looking.
Thank you.
I miss the days of IRC. I don't know. I kind of miss the days of like us kind of sort of being anonymous and like still being real human beings.
I miss each other. Anonymity on the internet.
Right?
A lot. Like, yeah. And not terrible trolls being jerks anonymity, but like, I don't know.
I had a lot of great times on IRC.
I had a bunch of like weird friends and I don't know who they are to this day. And I like that. Like, I think it's really cool. Like Dead Journal and Live Journal and Zanga were really interesting places to grow up. Because you are actually around all these people and you're, you know, getting into their deepest thoughts and then you never really meet them. And it was cool.
I'm super excited for people to be more honest again on the internet because right now we're all living in like hashtag FOMO. And
hashtag FOMO and hashtag YOLO at the same time. It's
hashtag
amazing.
FOMO, hashtag YOLO. Yeah. And I feel like the early days of the internet, people were saying real stuff.
Right.
Like they were being very honest.
As opposed to now where like, I don't know, everything just feels like it has a VSCO filter followed by like a Snapseed edit followed by...
Which
like,
I'm guilty of. Like, I play the game.
But even thinking of like...
Guy and I don't wake up looking this way, Leah.
I do. I actually wake up looking this way. With the headphones on because I'm going to pass out on my desk.
Oh, no.
What do you mean by that? What for you is the early days of the internet and how has that changed now?
For me, the early days of the internet were like AOL.
Yeah. Well, don't prompt it. I want to hear it. Like what the,
Wait, AOL was great, you guys. They had whatever it was, like kids chat.
The internet that we grew up on was very much like Blogger, Live Journal, Zanga, where people were sharing their very truthful thoughts about like real people on the internet because there wasn't this insane search.
Late 90s, early 2000s?
Late 90s, early 2000s. Okay. That was like our era where people were being very real about who they were. They still had like a level of anonymity where like we still had like weird usernames and like no photographs of us.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're talking about like very real topics and talking about them in a way that we weren't trying to like promote our self-image or promote our internet selves.
Right. Yeah.
So, and I do miss that.
So was it because when your images became well known, the conversation kind of degraded? Is that?
No, I feel like it's when Facebook made real names mandatory that everybody started saying, oh, I want to share with my friends and family that are real and I know their born names, but it means that I can't share anything I don't want them to see. And also I think awareness of like, okay, so Facebook knows who I should tag in my photos before I tag them. It's like, okay, is it a matter of time before any single image of me on the internet, no matter how locked down it is, would be identified as me? And mm-hmm. does that mean that I can't even share my most intimate self with like anybody if there's a digital trace? That's kind of a, like that then turns off that ability of the internet to connect us to people who are more like us than anybody proximate to us. And I think that's kind of sad. I think that's a big change.
And I think we're like all sort of like if this is where the singularity happens, this is where it happens, where we all coalesce into this like perfect person who like goes on, you know, amazing hikes and takes amazing travels.
Granted,
and
this is the
always
only
happy.
Time I Instagram. Instagram
is a like, Potoki informed social
because we are very much not coalescing into that person.
Well, that's good to hear.
No, I had a really great time last week while traveling, and I was taking all these photos, and it was really weird to be thinking through what caption I would post them with. And when I caught myself doing it, I was like, hey, this is too important to you. You're trying to project a thing right now as opposed to share something authentic. And I'm sure there are plenty of people on the internet who like happen to share their authentic selves, and it just happens to be highly likable and marketable, but I don't know. I don't want to have to be both.
Well, also, yeah. what's the value? Like, why?
Because you get jobs that way.
Wait, why share or why?
I mean, the career building and brand, personal brand building.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of followers, like, why? Like you know, why is that a thing?
I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but for me, Twitter is extremely important to me. Like when I came back and I was a hot mess from my travels and like my breakup that I went through,
yeah,
I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I just reached out to Twitter like, hey, does anyone have any gigs? Like that was extremely meaningful to me. And then the way that was cultivated was because like I
brand,
you know, like it was like, I don't want to say I'm being disingenuous on Twitter, but I'm very mindful of what I tweet about and therefore like have built up this kind of like group of people who I talk to who would be able to help me in my time of need. And I don't know if that's shitty or if that's good. Like, I don't know if that makes me a shitty person or if that makes me authentic. I don't know. Yeah.
I don't think that makes you a shitty person at all. You're editorializing. Mm-hmm. Like your Twitty feed is a magazine.
You know, I remember
if people like your magazine, then they'll likely appreciate you.
And decades ago, it would have been like the Home and School Association where everyone goes and all the parents look perfect and everyone talks about their perfect lives.
Right. Definitely.
Just IRL.
So I remember when I was working on retail projects at Apple, Siri had been acquired by Apple, and there was this was the big scandal where Siri couldn't find Planned Parenthoods. And so for me, as a person who is obsessed with technology, was really excited about Siri and also cares about people having access to healthcare, I remember I tweeted something about it and I was like, this is messed up. And someone who worked at Apple, who like he and I had talked about, I don't know, motorcycles a while ago, DM'd me and was like, hey, you should take that down. And it was this And he was just saying it as a friend. He was like, you don't have to take it down, but
okay.
I think it would impact your career at Apple if you leave that up. And so I did take it down. And then maybe like 8 months later, joined the Siri team. But it always occurred to me that,
I think he was wrong, frankly.
I mean, maybe, but to some extent, I have like gotten phone calls about things on the internet or like people being like, hey, somebody wrote your name in a list of Apple employees you should be following on Twitter. Like, are you okay? Have you like, has this threatened your job in any way? Like, I think that the reality is it's hard to give nuanced feedback or nuanced thoughts on the internet. And it's very easy to judge someone on this like tiny nugget of insight into how they think. And so someone could have read that tweet from me and been like, oh, wow, she like really cares about healthcare and women's rights. Or they could have read it and been like, she doesn't understand how hard it is to develop software. Why would we ever hire this person? Like, and I think that ambiguity of interpretation is very possible when you're trying to encapsulate things in 140 characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so people just try to be
I say so much dumb stuff on Twitter. It's not even
but
no, but I honestly, look, I'm going to put that in the
you can't be lucky destroyed.
Privilege.
He has, like, plot armor.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. If you want to put it that way. Your initial statement, I don't think, was very... Ultimately, like, that's hard to defend if you're going to not... How is anybody going to be mad at you for that? Like,
I totally agree, but I think that it's just, since we're all afraid of our things being taken out of context.
Right.
And we should be, because the internet is full of trolls. It's dark and full of terrors. we then have to present a version of ourselves that is milquetoast enough that no one will take issue with it. And I think that it's kind of sad because it prevents the opportunity for a really good conversation. Like, I had that person reach out and said, well, like, why do you think that happened? And then I could say, blah, 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 like, Apple hates women, which obviously I wouldn't have said. But, like, if I had the opportunity to say that, and then he could have said, well, like, do you know how algorithms work? Like, we could have this conversation. But the internet, for some reasons, it feels less like there's room for that, for people to learn from each other, and more it's a place for snap judgments. And so you want to be safe.
I hate it. Like, I hate the fact that, like, we're supposed to be super positive. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not naturally that type of person. Like,
I've met you for like all of about 30 seconds, and I don't like people either. So,
I don't want to say it because, like, that's a horrible thing to say in this time and age, but, like, I am a very critical person. I can be a huge asshole. Like, there's a lot of more things that I dislike than I like. And I used to be very, very, like open about that on the internet until, like, Leah, I got an email.
Cool, you.
Yeah.
Jets. Eh.
I got a DM from the, like, one of the evangelists at Apple at the time when I was, like, going on this huge rant about, like, the iTunes 10 logo icon.
Oh. You made Louis Mantia
cry. Sorry, Louis.
Yeah. Louis.
Louis's going to kill me.
He's not listening. He's at Disneyland.
We're going to Disneyland in like a month. and it's fucking crazy. Like, I just want to say what I want to say, and I want people to not be offended by it.
Right.
And I've had to be a completely opposite person.
Have you ever seen the movie Usual Suspects?
Oh, yes, I have.
So, like, I describe it this way. So in Usual Suspects, the only thing you don't know is who Kaiser Sose is. And then at the end, you find out who Kaiser Sose is, but then you don't know if the rest of the movie is a complete lie or not. And mm-hmm. It seems to me that that's sort of the modern model for the internet, is that as soon as you know who somebody is, suddenly, because they have identity, you can't believe anything they say anymore. So the more real our identity became, the less real our conversations have to become, because we're all very protective once we think that we're an unknown commodity.
Oh, God.
I don't know. I think that's...
Except for you, Guy.
We're way off in the weeds now. Well, yeah. I'm an asshole on Twitter and in real life, really. But I think that's... I think the benefit of doubt is extended more... for me than it is for women, certainly.
Yes.
Like, I get to be a jerk, and women don't. And I can kind of just roll with it and crack jokes, and people are like, he's so funny. But it's, even if it's a bad joke, it's not that funny. But I feel women are kind of trapped into this space where they need to be... either super professional and very conservative in what they say, or giggly and engaged in a way that's disarming.
Or make it their personal brand to be controversial, as opposed to getting to dip in and out.
Sure. Okay.
Of whoever they are, right? Like,
sure. Okay. So maybe there's a triangle there where you land somewhere in the triangle. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Do you think that's a fair...
Two really good examples of that from my personal life. One of them being, like, I was in a meeting this one time with, like, obviously a group full of men, and I was just totally being myself, not going out of the way to be an asshole, just saying like, hey, you know, have you thought about designing this in a different way? Have you thought about using this technology? And then in the middle of that meeting, someone said, you know, you're being really catty right now. And I'm just like, no one would ever say that to a man. No one would ever say the word catty, for example. That's very much associated to women.
Yeah.
It's so gendered and it's synonymous to just saying you're being a bitch right now. And I could not, I'm not being any more controversial than any person in this room.
No, it's the weasel words for saying you're being a bitch.
Exactly.
Like,
and
you don't even have the guts to say that you're being a bitch. Like,
true. I took such offense to that, and I had a humongously long talk with that man about like how inappropriate that was and how I was like, you should not treat someone like that. And another point was like, one day I woke up and I wrote a blog post about like Apple Pencil versus Wacom Cintiq, because I'm very opinionated about that. It's just a very
great post.
For good reason.
Because
yeah. Did a little bit of work on that.
Shit. And I didn't mention at all that I worked on the pencil. I didn't want any association with that. The emails that I got from that, the personal emails that they had sought out my personal email address, they were a combination of just like misogynistic emails, rape threats, death threats. For having an opinion on
criticizing a shitty tablet.
Stylus and a tablet. Like, you could not get more vanilla than this. And it all came back to like, you're being such a bitch about like the way that you talk about these products. And it blew my mind. And it really took a toll on me. Like, I was crying in the middle of like a conference because of this. Because of like the torrent of emails that I was getting, and like had to be supported by like all of my friends through it. And I was like, I'm never going to write something like this again. My voice is silence. Like, screw this. Never again. Won't do it at all. You don't feel comfortable telling that to the outside world. Like, you don't feel comfortable saying that that is what happened to you, because you feel like that puts you in a less position.
Oh, so
power.
You're a victim. Like, that's kind of what
exactly,
happens.
Exactly.
Like, oh, yeah, then you're playing like
that's what defines you as opposed to having opinions.
Exactly. And it pisses me off so hard. And I don't know the solution to this. It just sucks. And I just want to say it because it happened to me and it fucking sucked.
So if you want to reach Linda, you can reach her at catty_1@kickingbear.com.
Yeah.
catty_2@kickingbear.com. Perfect. And I promise you they will both read all of those messages. So please funnel them. Just send them there.
I'll have someone read them to us in our VR corner.
Through a natural language interface.
Exactly.
Those are getting printed out and put in the furnace. That's what's happening. Yeah. Are the contributions of women being undervalued by the technical community at large? I mean, I think the obvious answer is yes. But if so, and I believe it is. Is there anything that you can think of to address it? Like, well, like what? I mean, one simple trick makes you lose 80 pounds. I mean, what's the, which is dumb. It's a dumb question, ultimately, on the face of it. But I mean, what irks you most? Like, what's like this, like one simple thing that people can do to sort of make it easier to accept contributions from, you know, the both of you and from women in general?
Not making it specific to women, because I don't know. I like women are cool, but
sorry. Okay, maybe even
No. Sorry. I was just talking.
Underrepresented voices. Let's put it that way.
But no, I would say amplifying voices who are not yours is always a good thing, right? And I would say that there's a difference between grandstanding about how much you want women's voices to be heard and talking about those issues and just like retweeting women or like, you know, sharing women's content and attributing it to them. I think I've seen a lot of people who, with very good intentions, will, you know, sort of white knight about things and be like, oh my God, this horrible thing is happening. And as much as I want you to know about the horrible thing, you probably already know about the horrible thing. I want you to know that I'm the kind of person who cares about the horrible thing. And I think that
it's a hard position to put someone else in, though.
Like, what do you mean?
The whole white knighting thing.
Make it about them, not about yourself.
Right. Yeah. It's just like let's just all amplify each other's voices. Like, I should probably, the best way I can serve communities that are not mine is not by talking about how much they need to be served. It's like by going out and volunteering and amplifying other people's voices and trying to, when I'm referring someone for a job or for a conference or for an event, thinking about people who are not from my immediate group and like, and making an effort to do that, not because of a favor, but because, you know, that's like, that is the tiny way I can contribute to offsetting society's ills. That is how I try to think about it. And I like to see other people, but like when I see somebody amplifying another person's voice, I think that is the cool thing. And I don't know.
For me, it's just fucking believing in what a person is trying to tell you. Like, for me, it's just like, when I have an experience, believe that I actually had that experience, that I'm not making it up.
Right. When Sansa Stark is telling you that you should not just fall for Ramsay's traps,
listen to Sansa Stark.
Listen to her.
Don't make her wait until you
guys... She saved the day. She totally saved the day.
Order.
She was literally brought in the cavalry.
Yeah, like she saved everyone with the veil, but you know what? She wouldn't have had to. She wouldn't have had to like go to Littlefinger. Had Jon Snow just listened to her.
And not been such a diva.
Because she had the best experience with Ramsay Bolton. So that's what I'm saying. If someone says, I know Ramsay Bolton, just believe
just
that
listen.
They know Ramsay Bolton.
Just listen.
Okay, this got weirdly trippy.
I think we're done with this angry.
We
so
are.
That
oh, you don't know. You're all out of.
That is what happens.
It's a one sangria show.
Interview ever. Like, nah, we're all out of juice.
Let's all go rewatch the finale of Game of Thrones
because it was great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So good.
Great. Yeah. Any final thoughts?
I don't know. What are you guys up to?
I know. What are you guys up to?
It's been all over the map, and a bunch of it I didn't intend to cover, but I'm very happy that we did.
We can ask them where to find them on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There it's catty_com.
Is there a social network you'd like to point people towards?
Twitter. I use the internet.
AIM.
Yeah. No, Twitter is cool.
Yeah.
Don't give them your IRC handle. Just give them your Twitter.
Okay, yeah. No, my Twitter is Leah Naps, LIA Naps, because I like to nap, and also it's part of my last name.
Mine is boringly at Linda Dong, because my name is at Linda Dong.
Yeah, no, it's perfect.
You will not believe this, but at is actually the first letter in her name.
Yes, exactly.
It's presages Twitter.
I signed my resignation letter with my cash tag.
Did you?
$ Linda Dong.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
That's
nice. Hashtag worth it.
Probably illegal. You're still
right. You still work for Apple.
All else, yeah.
Surprise.
Well, thank you both so much. That was absolutely delightful.